in support of a governor or in support of their own interests simply to seek modifications which are in their interest. Almost all of the fights, including one, the first one that was made, which was really by Yakutat and Sea Alaska, have been made pretty much as a singular effort by a village or by a corporation. And I simply throw that out as a case study of the way that I think a major resource development decision for this state, and perhaps a major environmental effect on this state, and certainly a major socioeconomic effect, has essentially not been dealt with well by the natives, or I would suggest, if I may for just a second, not dealt with in their cumulative self-interest as well as it could be because of the kind of broken up corporate structure that they have. Finally, let me just say one thing about all of these really address Walt's paper, but one thing I think that you said in your paper is very valuable for us to keep in mind, and that is that even with the difficulties of the corporate structure, I'm obviously saying it's going to be a hard one to move away from, and maybe not even an appropriate one to move away from. I think you've done a good job in your paper pointing out the options that are still available within that structure. That is, in something as important as the land management issues, there are a wide range of trust arrangements possible which could accomplish exactly the kinds of objectives that people say they want from the reorganization under the IRA. There's the possibility of making changes in Congress or in state law which allow Native corporations to do a whole host of creative things with their land, which would solve many of the problems of alienability and speculation that you mentioned. And they obviously have the primary choice whether to keep or sell the land, which Byron points out has been exercised well and responsibly. The issue, of course, is whether or not they will do that, or whether or not they, speaking of the natives cumulatively, have a one-shot opportunity to go to Congress or somewhere else, and in one moment of unity among the corporations to create a new approach to this whole thing, or whether or not they can, over the years, develop and gain support for, maybe is a better way to say it, a series of actions which corporations can take which accomplish all those same ends. And I think your paper does a nice job of saying that in many respects they have most of the power in their hands to do that right now. The question is, with this corporate identity which seems to be pronounced, they will do it or can do it.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Dave Hickok, perhaps you could give us your views.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we all look through different windows on history, and indeed every people from the Chinese on have tried to rewrite history, some with various success and some with none. I liked many of the comments that Guy made in placing a perspective on what's happened here. And I'd like to add a couple of more points of perspective, if I may, as an introduction. First, the institutional and legal regimes that we're talking about here do have a foundation in our history. It was Justice Marshall in the 1790s who really set the framework for how the United States would deal with indigenous peoples in the westward expansion of our country. And those were only by three things: by war, by treaty, by purchase or compensation. Now, as the United States swept westward and northward to Alaska, three forces were in effect. One was the force of westward expansion, economic growth, dominion, progress, greed, if you will, certainly development of resources, and et cetera. The second was the rising acknowledgement across the country that culminated here in Alaska, finally with ANSCA, but which actually did not culminate because some of the results here have gone back east to deal with the Passamaquoddy and the Shoshone and so on. But nevertheless, that Aboriginal rights would be resolved. And The third was the force of science and conservation. These three forces north finally came into very close interaction here in the past 25 years. Statehood was certainly the culmination of westward expansion. Aboriginal rights and indigenous peoples' rights in Anska came shortly thereafter, and followed by that were the resolution of those scientific and conservation interests that had also begun in the 19th century, and all three of these forces have came together in the past 25 years in a trilon of interaction and activity. Now, given that interaction of those forces, I think it's important to say, on the basis of some of the comments of the past few days, that no individual over the whole period of the development of Anska was involved with every phase. Not a single man living or dead, or woman either. There were seven phases of Anska as I see it. One was in the 1940s and 50s when there were a few bills introduced. The other was that brief flurry of activity in 62 to 64 when the folks in Fairbanks were creating Al Ketzler and the rest were working on bringing people together, and Howard Rock was beginning his activities. And then the most significant thing of all happened. There was an earthquake in this state. That earthquake was the turning point of the native land claim movement, whether people realize it or not. Arising from the earthquake, there was a very unique report to the President of the United States. It is very, very little known, and indeed a very rare document to this day. In that report, one of the authors who is here today, Joe Fitzgerald and Doug Jones, wrote a report to the President on the economic prospects for Alaska. That report said, in part, there can be no economic progress in Alaska without the settlement of Aboriginal claims. And that it was a turning point without any question in historic terms. Now, as that happened, another very unique and historic event took place. The first time in American history, Chairman Jackson of the United States Senate, Secretary Udall of the Department of Interior, and Joe Fitzgerald, who was the chairman of an independent commission who reported not in any bureaucracy, but rather to the full cabinet at large, made an agreement, and it's only about two paragraphs long. Basically says that the Federal Field Committee would do the study, Interior would pay for it, and the Congress would act upon it. And no other time in my recollection in national history has that ever taken place. From 1964 then, particularly October of 64 when the Field Committee came in being, until 1969, there was an activity where most of the substantive work on native land claims centered in that committee and in the dialogue with the native community and in the Congress that was created. Following the passage of, I think this bill, Van Ness might correct me, I think it was the second version of Anska in the Senate, the House dialogue heated up in 1970 and 1971. And that was really a period of negotiation. Then from January 72 to 76 was the first period of implementation on Anska, and 76 to 84, a second wave of implementation. I point again, in those seven periods, not a single soul, living or dead, worked in all of those phases and all of those activities, so that the perspectives, the windows from which all of us look, are colored by what we worked on. And then they were manipulated and massaged by others who followed. And that really is the evolutionary effort, the evolutionary process that shaped ANSCA entirely. Now, the one thing that I think needs another bit of perspective that needs emphasis, the Native Land Claims Act was and is an act of compensation. It is true that there are social and economic aspects as corollaries, but it is primarily an act of compensation. For lands taken by the United States, this was the redress made to the people, Native people of Alaska, in money and in land returned. Now, I think it's important to realize that the institutions of the Act were not only social and economic devices, but they were also the recipients of the compensation. They were created to receive the compensation. The many other recipients of the compensation were considered. There was, for example, as others point out, the lower 48 experience of reservations. There was also considered termination, which was a process of the times in the Menominee and the Klamath termination. There was also considered the IRAs, despite all the conventional wisdom around here, that IRAs were not considered, they were considered. And they were rejected primarily on the basis of the trusteeship relationship to IRAs. The Native people at the time in the early 60s wanted the BIA and the federal government out of their affairs. And so there was consideration. There were only 9 IRA corporations in Alaska in 1966. And since then, there have been a slew of them created. Now, I'd like to raise one other point in these terms of reference. There is nothing in this statute that prevents the Native people from realigning themselves, their institutional structure of their assets, once they've received their assets. Think about that, some of you attorneys. Because once the corporate assets, the transfer of the federal compensation has taken place to any corporation, that corporation can realign its assets in whatever way it wants to. Now, there has been talk also of the word sovereignty, and that was not addressed. Sovereignty certainly was addressed. Now, sovereignty is a much ill-used word in this dialogue. Sovereignty, there is only one sovereign in the United States, and that is the federal government. When folks talk about sovereignty in the terms of Indian reservations, all of the powers of the federal government are not delegated to Indian reservations. There is a trusteeship. There are all kinds of hooks on the three forms of jurisdiction that make up sovereignty, which are proprietary jurisdiction, legislative jurisdiction, and judicial jurisdiction. Now, while it may be true that parts of these packages are given in terms of reservations or other historic arrangements with Native people, all of them are not. And The main dialogue in ANSCA about the question of sovereignty settled over the question of legislative jurisdiction. What would be the legislative jurisdiction of Native peoples, of the state of Alaska, and of the federal government? In great measure, the dialogue centered on fish and wildlife jurisdiction. In many of the pre-ANSCA executive orders and so on, there were statements, and you can look them up, that basically said that fish and wildlife are reserved to the local native people. These were discussed at some length in the Federal Field Committee study and also in the Congress. Indeed, three governors of Alaska, the reason they made statements before the Congress on the subsistence situation was that they did not, the Congress was not about to grant legislative jurisdiction over fish and wildlife to indigenous people in Alaska, because it would open up a can of worms throughout the whole western states on the control of fish and wildlife resources. And the Congress said, no way, we're going to open that one up. So in response to that, Governors Egan and Hickel and Miller all went on record as saying, hey, the state will take care of subsistence problems. Similarly, someone mentioned that the offshore was not addressed. Again, you have to put this in the perspective that the package of lands and money was compensation. There was a consideration of offshore interests as part of the compensation in the Senate version of the bill, but that came out over the interaction period. One last thought, and that has to do with the evolution of the corporate idea. Corporate idea began as a quasi-federal state, a federal native corporation, very much like ComSat. That was the original device. Gradually, this was changed into a statewide corporation for all native peoples. And if you look at the passage of the first two in the Senate, of the first two bills that passed the Senate, you will see that the corporate version in those acts was a statewide system, an umbrella, if you will, under which villages and local, regional, and village entities were involved. The corporation, in effect, was a big brother of their own. Now, the corporation on that scale would have meant that the native land claim settlement to that corporation would have been the 11th largest corporation in the world. And Aspinall and others said, whoo, no way are we going to allow this power base to exist in Alaska. So with that aspect of concern for the massiveness of this corporation, which had, by the way, both interests of nonprofit and profit concerned with it. It was to be a funneling device for native monies that would native compensation monies that would go to the enhancement of village life. That was the main structure of the Senate version. It was, ironically enough, two of the greatest advocates of change in the Native community, Charlie Edwardson and Joe Ubikson, who before Congressman Aspinall made the case for private corporations of profit. And that's on the record, and somebody could look it up if they don't believe me. So the change really towards economic development corporations came from the native community itself, not from any lawyers, advisors, what have you. And I think that's an interesting footnote to end what I have to say, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickok. I think we might just continue in this way, if that's all right with the members of the roundtable, and later on get into some exchanges between one another. But I find all of this fascinating, and might I t- take advantage again of my prerogative as chairman to raise a couple of things. Dave Hickok said that there's only one sovereignty in the United States. In Canada, we study United States history, and we were taught that you, as the inventors of federalism, invented the idea of two sovereignties within a single state. We also, in Canada, base the idea of native claims and native rights on the judgments of Chief Justice John Marshall handed down in the last century, where he described the native people as constituting domestic dependent nations. And I think he used the expression diminished sovereignty. They had a diminished sovereignty. Well, this expression is yours. You invented it. And it has been adopted in Canada and virtually every other country where there are indigenous minorities. And President Reagan, in his statement on U.S. Policy towards Native Americans in January last year, reaffirmed in the most emphatic language the notion of Native sovereignty. I think he made it clear that he was speaking of what he called recognized IRA councils at the time, of which I think there are some in Alaska. But that expression may be one that carries all kinds of implications that certainly Chief Justice Marshall never intended, and for all I know, President Reagan never intended, but there it is, and I suppose we have to live with it.
But it's a diminished...
Oh, yes. No, what he said.
Finished rather than sovereignty.
Yes. But could I just tell you that when I held a meeting at Tununuk last week, at Amonic, people said people were concerned about the land and about subsistence. At Tununuk, they were concerned about the land and about subsistence and concerned about what I think we could safely call self-rule. I can't remember whether anyone used the expression sovereignty, but they thought of themselves as people who ought to be able to make laws governing the use of the lands they thought to be their own. And that raises the question of political institutions for Alaska Natives, and I think it's one that perhaps later on you might want to consider. Perhaps also you might tell me, if you feel like expressing an opinion, whether Dave Hickok's view about the complete freedom that the corporations have to realign their assets is something you agree with. That is, once all the land is conveyed, would they have the power to place it in the hands of an IRA or in some other form of trust or to some other entity? Or if they divested themselves virtually altogether of their lands, would they be transforming themselves in a way that would give rise to minority shareholders' lawsuits? I mean, I'm sure lawsuits would accompany anything that happens in Alaska, but whether those lawsuits would be based on what you conceive to be sound principles. The only other thing that occurred to me arising out of Dave Hickok's presentation was this business of this statewide corporation that would have been the 11th largest in the world. Well, I'm curious to know if anybody wants to tell me why that frightened everybody to death. If it had been a corporation in Texas that had no native shareholders and was going to be the 11th largest in the world, would people have said we can't have that? I don't know. But, Charlie Johnson.
I'd like to kind of address the issue that you brought up about sovereignty and partly in relation to what Dave Hickok has said. You know, being from Western Alaska and from a village out there, I really think that what our people talk about or think about when they talk about sovereignty is a freedom, and a freedom to kind of be left alone for one, or a freedom to choose maybe not as individuals, but as a group of people, a course of action. I think that is a more relevant term for sovereignty for us than, more relevant use of the term sovereign than the idea of a government capability of government-to-government relationship or taxing authority or whatever we assign sovereignty to mean. And if, in fact, that it's true with what Mr. Hickok has said about the freedom of realigning assets and the freedom of use of land in our native corporations, and if we are interpreting, at least maybe if I am interpreting right, what I listen to when my people say really what they want to be is to be able to make that choice of how we use our land, keep our land, or whatever. Maybe, in fact, according to those types of definitions, we've achieved that type of sovereignty if, in fact, it means freedom. Now, in relation to the use of the corporations, there's been no question that the corporations are fraught with shortcomings. And when we talk about expectations, I know it's been brought up that some of our own people ask for corporations. When we look at the timelines that were given us, I think there were some expectations on the other side that we were expected in one quantum leap of 20 years to be full-fledged capitalist with the type of discipline that Byron Mallott talked about, with the ability to totally use our assets for economic development or for whatever, that there was some expectations on the side of Congress that we do that. Also, I think that when you look at the opening up of the corporations to public or to other ownership, the sale of stock or the issuance of new stock, I'm wondering if an expectation was there that we would form some beneficial partnerships. Was that the thinking at the time, that we would be skillful enough or have the type of corporate abilities that major corporations have that do issue stock and control and utilize that incoming capital or utilize the skills of people that would come in with that sale of stock as a partnership in our native corporations? Now, going back to the sovereignty issue, and if in fact we are talking of freedom as a sovereign, as a sovereignty, then we look at not the corporations as being the deterioration of the freedom that we would have, because certainly the corporations give us a whole wide range of flexibility. The issue of IRA councils and trust relationship, you know, must be talked about, because had we taken that as the alternative, there is no guarantee anymore that an IRA council will keep us as unique or sovereign people than a corporation would, because certainly the history of that in the U.S. indicates that because you are an IRA council is no guarantee of your survival as a people. The thing that really, I think, is deteriorating our freedoms of choices is the imposition of state institutions over the native, in Native Alaska. You know, the state does not refer to us as natives. They refer to us generally as rural people. And when we look at the state institutions that are being now developed, we see different layers of government that really limit the ability of Native people and the use of Native-owned land. And let me give you a great example of it: the Coastal Zone Boards. is a great example of that. The coastal zone boards treat native-owned land as public lands. They treat the use of native-owned lands as public lands. Now, some people have championed the coastal zone boards as our method or our local method of dealing with offshore oil and the giant oil companies and all that. But there is nothing in the coastal zone management law or the regulations that allows the private landowner a say as a landowner in what happens on the regulations or the authority, the zoning authority of the coastal zone boards. The same could be true of, for example, the boroughs that the state wants to develop in the rural areas. You know, we have city councils now. The state says you must have a city council. We could have a traditional government, but the state can come in and say, we don't care if that individual is your chief. We don't care how, unless you do it with a ballot box that the state verifies, we're not going to take your word or your traditional methods of election or acknowledge or whatever method we always traditionally use to choose our leadership. And the leadership that sometimes develops out of these state institutions are not the leadership that would otherwise be developed when we do it either traditionally or without interference from rules put on us by the state. So when we talk about sovereignty, I think that the use of IRAs or the placement of IRAs as a cure to some of our sovereignty issues is really fraught with a whole bunch of disadvantages that are not necessarily being talked about. One, with IRAs, we don't have the economic clout that we have with corporations. We don't have the ability to deal effectively with state government as an IRA council in the same method that we can deal with them as economic powers that we have with the corporations. There's only one way I think that could develop in that sense, is if there is some corporate or economic institution that would go with that IRA council. And if the IRA council, if in fact we're going to go back to IRAs, can develop an economic base like the corporations we now have. So we have a real dilemma here of some imposition on us of state institutions at the same time that we're trying to express our own freedom or sovereignty, if you want to call it that. Because I really think that in most of, at least in my area and Western Alaska, that when we talk about sovereignty, we're really meaning freedom of choice and freedom of action. Whether or not that corporation totally gives us that remains to be seen. And with the land issues and the protection that we're seeking for our land and the ability to use it as we choose without external pressure such as taxation or adverse possession, those questions need to be solved by us if we're going to continue that freedom of choice.
There's one other footnote on this corporation thing.
Cock, sorry.
And I think it's an important one. Most people think about corporations in capitalistic terms. It's rather really a very socialistic device. There is one vote for every unit of asset. And so the freedom of choice, I believe, is up to the various people right now. As soon as they receive their compensation, I believe that they can realign how they manage their and protect their assets and futures.
You're bringing up a very good point about our corporations, and that the election of people in corporations is done and is a political process rather than a process that you would otherwise use in the election of directors or management in a normal United States corporation. You take, for example, the corporate board of a bank. You bring in people either that own large blocks of shares or have the type of abilities that you are looking for contribution to the effective management of that particular corporation. And our native corporations, while that may be partly true, generally what has happened is that those with the most effective political skills, you know, are elected. We're trying to change it now in our region to where we have a broader political base, and we have a representative from each village. But, you know, that process is a political one, and the representation on the boards and management of corporations is primarily a political process rather than an economic contribution type process or a skill contribution that you would find in a normal corporation. One other comment about corporations in relation to your one giant corporation. If you look at the reasons for particularly regional corporations' existence, what I see in them, and I don't know how wide felt this is, but it seems like right now the primary function of the regional corporations is the distribution of wealth, the development of resources and the distribution of wealth. That kind of ties back to what you were talking about, the one giant corporation, but now we're tied in the same way by Section 7I, which dictates that we distribute 70% of our net revenues or our revenues to the pool. And when you look at the actual function of the regional corporations as a development and management of resources and the distribution of wealth.
Well, Mr. Hickok, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Hickok, the 7I provision that Mr. Johnson just referred to is certainly, I guess, a socialistic provision. That's the redistribution of wealth that Mr. Johnson referred to. Perhaps later, Mr. Malott might comment on what Mr. Johnson said about the elections within the corporations being primarily political, and to what extent that may be consistent or inconsistent with serving the profit-making objectives of the corporations. I know that these institutions have served both economic and political purposes, and somebody referred earlier to the fight they waged on the subsistence referendum in 1982. A most important contribution to the native cause, but perhaps we might come back to that later. Mr. Havelock, maybe we could turn to you since you're writing a lot of notes there.
Thank you.
Could you use this microphone?
Yeah. I'm sure, like everybody here, I've been dying to say something, and I'm conscious of the fact that there are a variety of different communities here, and I'm glad you spoke, Charlie, because I was thinking, you know, if we had another of these non-native folks around here opinioning about it, that I couldn't very well want to follow in that train, because we've got to alternate back and forth. As others have commented, it's kind of, in a lot of ways, it's a lot of fun to be back and see the people who are originally involved in putting this thing together. I don't know whether the program properly identifies everybody, you know, but I mean, Bill Van Ness over there was Jackson's person, and Dave was speaking for the commission, as he said, that historically put the thing together, and Doug here was the Gravel's person, and as the guy said, he was working for Begich, and my role was, I was Attorney General at the time, and I was Egan's person, as I represented institutional interests of the state, although prior to Egan's election, I'd been active in pushing for a native claims settlement as a citizen. The native community was always something of a mystery to me. I knew there were tremendous political things going on, but for their own strategic reasons, Native groups met by and large by themselves, and then, you know, Don Wright would pop up with an opinion, and you knew that there had been tremendous combat had gone on and division of forces, and Fred Paul had, I know it had his 2 cents worth in, and they come out with a position, but I never could tell the structure other than to the extent of the, you know, the conspicuous role of the North Slope, the way that the rest of us who were in some sense technocrats were, whose roles were readily identifiable. So the table actually would have to be really to have 100 different sides, you know, and then lurking in the back were the big oil companies that had their things. Yeah. I want to get a hold of Bill Foster's memoirs someday. He was a principal lobbyist. I'm sure he doesn't like to do a whole lot of talking because he knows where a lot of bones were buried in relation to the industry. I say it would be a table with multiple sides if every interest was allowed to belly up to this table. And I think all of us, as Dave remarked, have sort of the problem of holding on to a different piece of the elephant and describing ANSCA according to the particulars of our own institutional point of view. I'm sure all of us saw at that time and have greatly seen since the imperfections in ANSCA. And from my current perspective of a law professor, I'd like to say to reassure everyone that that's great. You know, the nature of law is to be conservative, to fall behind the times. And what we all thought, or many of us thought, was a great instrument at the time is more and more outdated by the needs of people today, never mind the historic aspirations, but just looking at where people are today and what they perceive as their needs. So I'm really delighted, and I think it is highly appropriate for people to take a look at ANCSA and the institutions that have grown out of it and say, do we have an adequate legal structure today to support the aspirations of Native people in the American constitutional context and, for that matter, in the larger system of values which is worldwide? I'd like to emphasize some of the imperfections that became immediate after the Settlement Act. So I know all of you are aware of them, and some of you have touched on them, but I haven't heard much of a list. One was the total failure of ANSCA to get itself involved in any kind of serious educational effort. Whatever happened in education was ad hoc after the fact. And here you were putting on a Native people a complex system of corporate law and understandings in the commercial community, which people were simply totally incapable of handling. I teach business law now, you know, I teach corporations. The people that have spent their whole lives in Western civilization don't understand how corporations work. And here we're dealing with people who were working, coming out of a subsistence culture, and somehow expecting some sort of magic to make this whole corporate structure work like it was ARCO or something. The second thing that was built into it was, I think, an assumption that we were dealing, particularly from the congressional side, that we were dealing with the economic man. Despite a good deal of rhetoric, ultimately the ANSCA is an act which deals with economic man, not with the cultural or family man or other aspects of man and his aspirations. Thirdly, clearly it seems to me now a lack of adequate attention to the control of land and the alienation of land. I happen to be, since we are occasionally taking points of heretical points here, I am much less concerned about the 91 horizon with respect to stock alienation than I am with the capability which was given immediately to Native corporations to alienate land in every respect. In a sense, it's an aspect of what Dave was talking about earlier with respect to the power that is involved in corporations to transfer lands, which he overstated, but which is still a point well worth mentioning. Despite what the state legislature was told last week, this is profoundly a federal question. And I think it's a great mistake to think that this is simply a matter for the state to be concerned with in the Native community. The emphasis has been given here that this is both a problem and an opportunity of the United States. The ANSCA did not amend the Constitution. and the special relationship of natives survives regardless of the acts that might be adopted by any particular Congress. I'm sure, as Guy was pointing out, from the point of view of Congressman Aspinall, this amounted to, in many ways, a termination statute, that, you know, let's wash our hands of this project. I think that's unconstitutionally unsupportable. With respect to, just to identify some of these federal responsibilities,
Could you repeat that?
You
said it's constitutionally or unconstitutionally unsupportable?
Constitutionally unsupportable that ANSCA ends federal responsibility for the native relations, the Indian relations, the special relationship of the federal government to the Indians of America generally, and the Alaska Natives in particular. What I see is, of course, that there are many powers at work that are still interested in making this into a termination statute and terminating the special relationship. And Byron commented on that in part in talking about the movement of the federal government away from its responsibilities with respect to the special relationship. But it seems to me that we do have something of a problem here with self-fulfilling prophecies to the extent that we say that the feds can get off the hook on this thing. It seemed to me there are major responsibilities for the United States, maybe hopefully not the United Nations, with respect to cross-cultural education, for example, where there are substantial conflicts of interest that the state has institutionally, which prevent it from doing a full job in the cross-cultural context. Even as an economic statute, it seems to me it should not be treated as a termination statute. And I think it would be deplorable for the Congress of the United States to allow the alienation of lands through creditors' possessions, for example, which it seems to me is a significant looming threat with respect to many native assets. I would suggest you look at, for example, the protections that are afforded to families and individuals with respect to homestead exemptions. It seems to me that we should have some kind of protection of native land from execution, from common judgment. You can't have a cultural heritage of a lifetime being allowed to disappear because somebody got behind on a bill, on a debt. With respect to knowing everybody here wants to talk, I'll just jump to some of the solutions.
Take your time.
Okay, well. there are a lot of people who haven't spoken. I know John Borbridge is full of ideas and wants to been criticized what others of us have said, particularly those of us that represent state or federal interests.
Mr. Borbridge has been here for 3 days and he's made a significant contribution. But you're a newcomer, and we know that
thank you.
You've got a lot to say to us
and
to others.
Thank you. One, in terms of the solution area, or that is the exploration of alternative institutional arrangements, which is, it seems to me, is what we're about here in these 3 days. One, it seems to me, is to look at the corporation in the larger context in which corporate law is being considered in this country generally, that some of you may be familiar with and some not. There is nothing engraved in granite about how corporations must be structured. It is, and it seems to me, to give it a context here, corporate law is part of a delegation of sovereignty by a sovereign state, to allow individuals who choose so to pick up a lawmaking function. I mean, that is the nature of private law in our society, which is based on contractual foundations, is to give to people the power to make law. And the state sets the parameters of how people are going to be allowed to make law
in the context of group activity. And that group activity arranges corporations or partnerships or joint stock ventures or whatever it is it's going to be. One of the things going on now in corporation law is a general recognition that general corporate law is totally inadequate to address, for example, the needs of the what is called a closely held corporation, the corporation that has a small number of shareholders and which historically has never done what the statute says it's supposed to do. You know, in a closely held corporation, you don't have meetings of shareholders, and you don't elect directors who then consider the policy. You know, all that is rolled into one ball. And one of the things that is going on now is a general revision in a number of states of corporate law to make the reality of the law conform with the reality of activity by creating special statutes for closely held corporations. And it seems to me that one of the things that needs to be looked at is whether we want to take a look at creating changing the form of corporation, of ANSCA corporations, particularly the village corporation, I may say, to reflect more the reality of people's aspirations and as the reality of what they do. To give you so one example of that, I know there was somebody once said that corporate democracy bears the relation to political democracy as martial music does to music. I think that we ought to look at how shareholder arrangements are put together. The contemporary corporation is structured to put all power in management. It's in many senses not a profoundly, very lightly democratic institution. Is anybody, if you study the structure of something like ARCO, you know, and you watch Mr. Anderson making $11 billion acquisitions of Gulf and things like this, you're not seeing democracy in action, you're seeing wheeling and dealing at the very highest level. And it seemed to me that one needs to ask whether this kind of format is that in which village aspirations can be met. Secondly, and this is maybe a second heresy for me, we are not living under an Anglo-Saxon system of land tenure and haven't in half a century. Anglo-Saxon land tenure would in fact be more amenable to the kind of structure that would be liked and appreciated here, because under Anglo-Saxon land tenure was indivisible and was designed to hand down land from generation to generation. It followed out of a feudal system, sometimes given a bad name, but which in fact recognized continuity in group interest. With the rise of the commercial revolution, we started in America and in the UK treating land just like any other form of property. And it seems to me the most conspicuous aspect of land tenure today in its current system is its ultimate divisibility, that it is infinite divisibility into a system of rights and privileges and so on. And I think it would be desirable to recognize that in looking at the arrangements that might come out of a re-examination of ANCSA. For example, a couple of examples. One is I am concerned about the degree to which, despite what Byron has said about the absence of any major alienation of land, the extent to which, in fact, interest in land in the division of property that I have described has allowed for major alienations of land with respect to rights in land through the contracts for development of land, for example. And any contractual arrangement with respect to land in this concept of property has a way of restricting the use of that land and restricting the access to it and restricting the ability of people to operate to do, let's say, what Dave Hickok was saying, of taking the assets that you have and moving them somewhere else. I think you'd find right away if you, in many of the corporate areas, if you started moving land that you'd find resistance from people that felt they had contractual rights in that land already. On the other hand, it seems to me that there is something very useful here, perhaps, in the idea of separating out subsistence rights in land, which I think, as Byron has indicated, are very difficult for a corporation to hold while still pursuing its profit motive, and to take those subsistence rights and to convey them to some other institutional setting which will be uniquely concerned with the preservation of those kind of rights. The third kind of institutional setting that it seems to me you need to look at is state government. And when I say state government, I mean state local government, which is given several different forms in Alaska, but we are still dealing with very immature forms with respect to how local government is ultimately going to be expressed in Alaska. We now have a system of, you know, something called the unorganized borough, whatever that is, which stands out there as with having an undefined relationship, really, with the central state government. We have the school districts out there, which may form the basis of boroughs sometime. It's and it seems to me that one of the things that we need to look at is whether the existing state law governing local government provides adequate vehicles for the expression of the concerns of rural people. Now, I use that, Charlie, the phrase rural people, because one of the reasons why the federal relationship must always be kept in mind is that the state is constitutionally disabled from dealing with people on an ethnic or national basis. So the state always is moving in terms of rural people or economic descriptions. So it seems to me that keeping your eye on that federal relationship is essential. On the other hand, there may be, for example, another class of borough that needs to be created that could provide a more adequate vehicle for Native aspiration and perhaps avoid some of the problems that Charlie was talking about with respect to the tendency, which I remember very well from the ANSCA days, of non-Indigenous people ending up dominating municipal corporations, for example, in the area, and that scared off Native people for a generation or more from the use of them until the North Slope Borough started taking things in hand and really getting going and showing what you can do with a form of local government. The federal IRA, here I guess I'm with the conventional wisdom in a way. The although I think you need to look at the federal relationship, it seems doubtful to me, not being an IRA expert, and Dave Case ought to be here to talk about that, but it seems doubtful to me that a statute that was set up to meet the needs as perceived by the white community in the period between the two world wars as a form for Native expression would meet the needs of a modern Alaska Native concerns. On the other hand, it may be that some type of federal corporate existence is one of the options that needs to be looked at because of the special abilities of the federal government to move with respect to the Native relationship. I am not concerned about that as a non-Native person. After all, we already have lots of federal laws that enable federal corporations to come into existence. In principle, there's not necessarily a whole lot of difference between the United States establishing a system of national banks, which it does, and national bank corporations, and what they could do with respect to creating the capability for organizations that are formed to particularly fulfill the needs of Native people in Alaska, or for that matter, in the rest of the country. As several of you remarked, it seems to me that the major overriding thing, which I rejoice in, is recognizing something I can identify with, is the desire, and I think it was Charlie stated in particular, the desire that everybody has, native and non-native, for control of their own destiny. And bringing these kind of things close to the people is what ANSCA in many senses is all about, and it seems to me that ANSCA's success or failure needs to be judged in part on whether it has managed to do it. The thing that is different, and which I regret that I cannot in a very personal sense identify with, but can only in historical terms, is that the nature of our society here in the Western society is to emphasize individualism at the expense of group interests. So Alaska Natives have a unique sense of community, which is those of us that are not Natives do not have the opportunity to share. And that village identity, which must be preserved, it seems to me, is a major aspect of what you do in whatever direction you turn in forming the new round of the new legal framework, the adjusted legal framework for Native aspirations. I had a couple of footnotes just from things that other people said with respect to what Guy was saying about the absence of discussion of some issues, and Dave took a little crack at him here and there and some of the things that were discussed. It's all relative as to how much things were discussed. It seems to me that one also needs to look at the unconscious things that were going on. And one of the unconscious things going on was the analogy to the formation of the American Republic that was involved, which seems to me has been neglected in the literature on ANSCA. That is, that there is spotted throughout ANSCA observations on relationships in which you can see that some people were moved one way or another by the idea that the regional corporation was going to stand as a super sovereign in relation to villages, which would stand in the relate like states do to the United States. And I think that there's an unconscious adoption of this structure, and in part it seems to me one of the problems of ANSCA today is the problem which the founding fathers of the Republic had to face, which is that the original Constitution didn't work because it allowed for too many islands of and too much building of walls between groups and between villages, and there was too much combat. So in the Constitution of 1787, the founding fathers put together a new definition of sovereign relationships to take care of that problem. You know, we can see that, for example, in the absence of some of these institutions were created, you know, that were gaps. But have they adequately served the needs of Native people generally? For example, the Alaska Federation of Natives has no standing within the structure of the settlement, and it seems to me weaker than it needs to be with respect to fulfilling Native aspirations. The emphasis on the economic man in the formation of the Act meant that, and the absence of education meant that lawyers dominated the beginnings of the fulfilling of the ANSCA plan, and little consideration was given, despite statutory enablement, to the role that nonprofit organizations might play. And now we've seen that grow up as a result of people's recognition of that, and we have a network of regional and other nonprofit corporations that have grown up. But I don't think, to my mind, they are not as strong as they should be, and they do not get as much attention from Washington as they should with respect to fulfilling the responsibilities which, as I say, constitutionally, the federal government still has with respect to health and education and these fundamental things which were not addressed in the Native Claims Settlement Act. One thing you mentioned, Charlie, is sort of a footnote to the Act. You're talking about the problem of the condemnation power. This is maybe, maybe it just tells a little bit about how legislation is made. There was a concern when the act was being drafted that there would be, that condemnation power would be taken away from the state, or for that matter from federal institutions, with respect to the act. As it turned out, the condemnation power, although it's not been tested to the Supreme Court of the United States or anything yet, but I think by and large most legal opinion would be that that the condemnation power is there. But there was always a possibility that somebody would slip something into the act at the last minute. And that meant that the state insisted upon having much broader easement provisions than were really necessary, which causes all kinds of headaches for the first decade under the act. If the so you can see there was a trade-off operating there, and it seems to be much of the easement problem could have been avoided if you had a condemnation power, or if you and if you you know, and it ended up with a compromise situation, or with a situation that nobody really fully anticipated. I will comment on what you said too, Judge, with respect to whether Dave is correct with respect to the opportunity to alienate land, to the opportunity of the corporations to choose any form. I've already mentioned creditor interest, but there's quite a body of law with respect to minority interests, which would prevent on a, at least on the global way that he put it, on the transfer of lands to other entities, although it would be possible, it seems to me, particularly with state support and the amendment of, one as I was talking about the corporate code as it now stands, still says profit uber alles. And when you have that built in as a statutory thing, then profit overall, then it's going to be very hard. It lays a legal foundation for minorities to challenge transfers that are not related to that profit objective. That's probably enough for my rant. I feel a whole lot better having got that off my chest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Havelock. I make this observation that Mr. Malott pointed out that the corporations holding the land for 12 years now have not divested themselves of any of it. It's still in native hands. Mr. Havelock said, they may be divested of it involuntarily through creditors' attachments or execution or whatever it's called, and that is seized and sold for debt. I think that is the colloquial way of putting it. And Mr. Havelock suggested that that should be barred by law, that is, native corporate land should be immune from seizure for debt. And then he suggested similar safeguards should be built in on heritage lines. Pretty soon, if you go that route, you've got a kind of immunity that resembles very closely the immunity that the trust lands in the lower 48 have. And I just wonder if that doesn't weaken the economic clout that Mr. Johnson said the corporations have. If creditors know they can't attach your land, then sometimes they don't lend you money. Well,
the Alaska Railroad and other public corporations do a fine job of moving economically, although they are restricted with on alienation of their lands in a number of ways. That is, from creditors, you can't foreclose on the Alaska Railroad, for example.
Okay. I wonder if we could do this. This afternoon, I'll take the liberty of calling on Mr. Jones and then giving the last word to Mr. Van Ness, who has been described as Senator Jackson's right-hand man, and no doubt it's appropriate we should call on him to conclude these opening statements. And then I'll ask Walt Parker and others seated opposite us if they would like to make observations or ask questions, and perhaps we could proceed from there. So could we come back at 1:30? Would that be all right? Yeah, sure, sure. Let's just wait a couple of minutes.
Sure.
You get set up.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to give him.